Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
A majority of Americans support universal background checks on gun sales, but top GOP members are unwilling to budge.
If the president took a position on a bill so that we knew we would actually be making a law and not just having serial votes, I'd be happy to put it on the floor.
The biggest lies that the president has told include that he would do something about universal background checks.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway for September 4th, how gun lobbyists influence federal policies in the wake of mass shootings. Also on the show, in St. Louis, children are getting killed because of the everyday realities of gun violence.
They're either on the porch, or they're walking home, or on the sidewalk, or they're on the playground, and it's just these type of simple things that children normally do, and they're getting killed.
And older Americans are increasingly relying on home health care aides, but federal protections for these workers often fall short. All right, everyone, let's get started.
When a lot of our labor laws were written in the 1930s and a little bit later, domestic workers were explicitly left out of those laws.
All right, everyone, let's get started. Last month, following a weekend of deadly mass shootings in Dayton, Ohio, and El Paso, Texas, President Trump voiced public support for a policy that GOP politicians often oppose.
I can tell you there's tremendous goodwill for meaningful, I took it about meaningful, add that word, meaningful background checks so that sick and demented people don't carry around guns.
This past weekend, a gunman in Odessa, Texas, killed 7 people and injured more than 20. But speaking after that shooting, the president signaled a different stance on background checks.
If you look at the last 4 or 5, going back even 5 or 6 or 7 years, for the most part, as strong as you make your background checks, they would not have stopped any of it.
In an August phone call with Wayne LaPierre, chief executive of the National Rifle Association, the president reportedly told the gun lobbyists that he will stop calling for universal background checks. Currently, federal laws do not require background checks on gun sales made by private sellers or at gun shows. But the latest polling shows that 91% of Democrats and 79% of Republicans support closing that loophole. LaPierre and the NRA continue to exert major political sway in Washington, but the organization increasingly finds itself mired in controversy, from legal and financial uncertainty to its recent breakup with its longtime advertising firm. I'm Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway, we're looking into how gun lobbyists continue to influence pushes for gun control in D.C., even as the NRA weathers its internal storms. For more now, I'm joined by Alex Yablon, a reporter at The Trace, a nonprofit newsroom dedicated to gun-related issues. Alex, thanks for coming back on the show.
Thanks for having me.
And also with us is Richard Feldman, a former NRA regional political director and lobbyist, and also the author of Ricochet, a book about the NRA. Richard, good to have you with us.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Alex, let's start with you. We mentioned at the top that the NRA has been in financial and legal trouble recently. There have been investigations in Congress and by the New York Attorney General. Briefly, catch us up on what's happening in those cases.
Sure. So the NRA is having some of its materials sought after by some congressional committees who believe it may have committed campaign finance violations. And the Attorney General of New York, which has an enormous amount of power over the NRA because the organization is chartered in New York, is examining whether revelations of self-dealing and high-level corruption and financial mismanagement might have violated the organization's charter and local nonprofit laws. And so that's probably the more serious of the two investigations.
We know, Richard, that in April, the NRA president, Oliver North, at the time said the legal fees posed an existential threat to the financial stability of the NRA. That was in an internal memo. Richard, you've written about the inner workings of the NRA in your book, Ricochet. How does this compare to what we've seen in the past?
Well, frankly, we've never seen anything that even comes close to comparing. One has to probably go back to the 1970s to see an upheaval within the NRA anywhere approximating these ranks, and we haven't seen it in a generation. And certainly the final version of this story is yet to be written.
And I'm wondering, Richard, we mentioned that the NRA parted ways with its longtime advertising firm, Ackerman McQueen, shut down NRA TV as well. Are we noticing a shift in messaging from the NRA to its members?
Well, I haven't really seen it yet. Certainly, it's an opportunity for the NRA leadership to take a different tack.
I want to pose the next question to both of you. Alex, I'll ask you first. Again, the overwhelming majority of Americans on both sides of the political spectrum say they support background checks, and yet nothing has been done. Alex, why are politicians still unwilling to back gun control reforms, at the minimum background checks, if the majority of Americans in both parties support it?
Even though the majority of Americans support universal background checks, those who oppose it are extremely well organized and have this as kind of their top issue. So in primary elections, a small number of really engaged, passionate voters can make the difference in ways that general public sentiment might not. And particularly in the Republican Party, where politicians generally fear their right flank and the possibility of being primaried more than they fear, you know, a general election loss, that's led them to oppose policies like universal background checks that enjoy almost universal approval.
Richard, I'd love to get your thoughts on that. And I'm reminded of an editorial cartoon not too long ago where after another mass shooting in the United States, which killed civilians, there was an editorial cartoon that showed a number of civilians who had been killed and Uncle Sam essentially in the middle of this holding the NRA and saying, you're going to be okay, you'll be safe. Richard, that cartoon, I think, is emblematic of this issue of how the NRA has such a stronghold on some of our government officials. Would you agree?
This entire issue involving guns is an extraordinarily potent issue in the psyche of the American people. And after being involved for 40 years, I think it's more because it is a symbolic issue than it is about the guns themselves. And the language that we use to describe this issue almost determines the outcome of any policy considerations that we could move forward. Gun owners and non-gun owners alike are in almost universal, to use that word, agreement that dangerous, mentally challenged people shouldn't have guns, unsupervised juveniles shouldn't have access to guns, and violent predatory criminals shouldn't have access to guns. It makes you stop and wonder what we're fighting over. And I think the answer in many ways is we're not fighting over the policy, although we use policy language to describe the political fight that we're always having over one side or another or winning. Let's use this universal background check. The word universal is the word that gets in the craw of so many gun owners, the ones Alex rightly describes as the engaged activist ones. They're concerned that if every transfer of every gun at every juncture has to go through a background check and paperwork, we will come to a day where if you possess a gun that didn't, you must be in violation of something. Now, I agree with Alex and have since I ran the Firearm Industries Trade Association 20 years ago that when you transfer a gun to someone you don't know, essentially a commercial transaction, whether it be at a gun show, a flea market, an online sale, it should go through a background check. The rub comes in when you're transferring a gun to a relative, to a close friend. In my case, my former police chief. That's where the issue really hits the road. And if we would just sit back, we could all get 99% of what we want, which are those commercial transactions between strangers.
More recently, however, we know that the Odessa, Texas shooting that happened this weekend, according to the Associated Press, a law enforcement official told the AP that that shooter failed a 2014 background check due to, quote, a mental health issue. Alex, how effective are background checks really, and are they essentially the lowest hanging fruit here?
So in all but 18 states, you can buy a gun without going through a background check in a private sale like the ones that Richard was describing. And now this can be at a gun store or it can be arranged on, you know, through websites like ArmsList, which is kind of like Craigslist for guns. And so that really seriously undermines the effectiveness of a background check system. As we saw with the Odessa shooter, even though he was denied at a retail sale, there's an enormous supply of guns that can be accessed just through buying from private individuals. And when you sell a gun in a private sale, you're under no obligation to figure out if the person you're selling it to could be prohibited from buying one.
Richard, we just heard that Walmart has announced that it is going to stop selling guns, certain types of guns, and more importantly, ammunition. And they, of course, represent 20% of ammunition sales across the United States. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, my first thought was that in the 1950s, the largest seller of ammunition in the United States of America was F.W. Woolworth. And everyone knows what happened to them. Now, I'm not saying the same is happening to Walmart, but it just pushes, it really doesn't change much. Maybe it makes it a little less convenient for some people to purchase ammo, and they did have lower prices generally. But there are thousands of retail firearm dealers in this country that all sell ammunition, and you can buy ammunition in most states online.
Want to bring up the 2020 election here, Alex. We know the NRA played a significant role in getting Trump elected in 2016. With its current financial state and the other problems we mentioned at the top, what does this mean for 2020? Will they continue to have political sway?
Well, they absolutely still have the president's ear. As you discussed in the intro, President Trump quickly backtracked after, you know, saying he would back, you know, some kind of strengthening of background checks and personally assured Wayne LaPierre that he wouldn't do that. The question is, what about other Republicans? Are they going to start backing away? I think that some have been sending some very vague, tentative signals that they would like to vote for some kind of new gun reform that would have been unthinkable even a year ago. And even in places like Texas, you know, I saw this week Dan Patrick, the lieutenant governor there, who's a very strong ally of the NRA, who has dismissed things like red flag laws, call for a requirement that stranger-to-stranger gun sales go through background checks. And that's a pretty big change from the past.
Richard, I'd love to get your thoughts on that. Will the NRA have sway in 2020? We've got about 30 seconds in the segment.
Yeah, well, we make a mistake when people think that the NRA's power is based on its professional lobbyists in Washington. It's the fact that it's able to communicate with really tens of millions of Americans. It does whatever you agree on the gun issue or disagree, it does what you do in a democracy to be successful. You educate, you inform, and you motivate your supporters, and you get them to the polls on election day. And if you bring enough of them with you, you win.
Richard Fellman is a former NRA regional political director and author of Ricochet, a book about the NRA, and Alex Yablon is a reporter at The Trace. Thanks so much to you both.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Hey, this is Jill from Austin, and I am a Texan gun owner, and I absolutely support federal gun control legislation as long as it doesn't screw over people of color and folks with mental illness.
Yeah, my name's John, and I'm calling from Vine Grove, Kentucky. I do not support any further gun laws. There are enough laws restricting law-abiding gun owners already, and any more laws would have no impact on criminals. Thank you.
This is Trevor from Sacramento. The problem with the gun control proposals that are put up is that they only affect law-abiding citizens who are not the people we need to worry about. Most of these mass shooters have either never done anything wrong or have gotten around the system very easily.
I am a military veteran. I am a gun owner. And I am absolutely appalled that we are allowing our politics to kill our citizens, although not very surprised. What I want as the first act is a repeal of the prohibition of any research done by the National Institute of Health and the Center for Disease Control concerning how gun violence impacts communities and best practices and worst practices.
Hi, this is Randy from Portland, Oregon. We do not need to have assault rifles given out to mass in public. As a gun owner myself, I would prefer to see a specialized permit provide more protection and less loopholes for dangerous situations to occur.
Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or tweet us at The Takeaway.
This summer's high-profile mass shootings have put a renewed focus on Congress's inability to work toward a legislative solution. But beyond the headlines, gun violence is an epidemic that looms over the daily lives of Black and brown people across the United States. Just this weekend, for example, at least 43 people were shot and 8 were killed in Chicago. And in Mobile, Alabama, 10 people were injured during a shooting at a high school football game. In St. Louis, Missouri, the crisis has reached a new level of horror. Children are frequently being gunned down.
Since the beginning of the year, there has been a number of homicides here in St. Louis. But around April, the shootings kind of spiked. And now it's a little bit over a dozen children that have been killed by gun violence.
That's Andrea Henderson, a reporter with St. Louis Public Radio.
This past week, they had a town hall meeting that a lot of the parents and a lot of the community members, they were angry at local and state government. Now it's just affecting them on a daily basis. Now it seems like that these children are continuing to get killed, and it's not like they're out doing anything wrong. They're out and about in a normal childlike state. They're either on the porch or they're walking home or on the sidewalk or they're on the playground. And it's just these type of simple things that children normally do, and they're getting killed.
And to make matters worse, law enforcement has struggled to make arrests in most of these cases.
Police were unable to solve a lot of these murders only because they didn't really have a lot of leads. They didn't have a lot of motives. So they're basically begging the community members to come forward.
Missouri has some of the loosest gun laws in the country, and it was the second state in 2017 to allow people to carry guns without a permit. The Missouri Legislative Black Caucus pressured Missouri Governor Mike Parson to bring up the issue of gun violence at a special legislative session this month.
He stated at first that it most likely wouldn't happen, but now that they have been pressing Governor Parsons to do something about this, he's actually taken a step back, and there are talks about what he's going to possibly do for the gun violence crisis that's going on here in St. Louis.
And now the lack of state action has prompted federal attention. I spoke with Congressman Lacey Clay, who represents St. Louis in Missouri's 1st congressional district, about what his constituents are demanding in light of the ongoing gun deaths.
Last Wednesday night in St. Louis, I hosted a town hall meeting on gun violence at Harris Stowe State University. The community is hurting. They were reaching out for solutions, common sense solutions, to stem this gun violence that's almost happening on a daily basis in our community. We had over 1,000 people show up, the largest that I've ever held in St. Louis. And I'm here to tell your listeners, and as I told my constituents, that we can do something to end gun violence, and that starts by standing up together to demand action now, not later.
Congressman, one of the issues with demanding action, we just wrapped a segment right now talking about the influence that the NRA has, in particular on our national politics. But also, you know, we know that I'd love to hear what kind of action you want to demand, because even though Americans on both sides of the political spectrum say they're in favor of background checks, there doesn't seem to be any movement at the congressional level on this.
Well, let me first say that this country and my constituents have reached a tipping point. We have allowed a culture of easy access to guns to devolve into an epidemic of gun violence. And to me, this is a public health emergency, and that's how we need to approach it at all levels of government. It's time that we turn up the heat on the U.S. Senate to break the grip of the NRA on Congress and state legislature by passing the background checks, the assault weapons ban, and H.R. 3435, my new bill, to give local governments the freedom to regulate firearms in their respective jurisdictions without depending on their state legislature.
Congressman, there have been at least a dozen black children killed by guns in your district since April, and police are saying that they cannot solve many of these cases. What message is that sending to your constituents? We're talking about children here.
Well, and my new bill gives local governments control over restrictions on guns and ammunition. It gives local control to protect residents, neighborhoods, and first responders, too. But out of that town hall, I also heard that there was a level of mistrust between the community and prosecutors and police. That is why over 70% of these murders go unsolved, because the people in the community, the witnesses, will not step forward. So it tells me there may need to be an effort on the part of the federal government in the area of witness protection and some type of cooperative witness protection that actually protects witnesses. And so those are the kind of ideas that I gathered from that town hall last week. And that's what residents in my community are looking for, some solutions, some answers.
Well, Congressman, your district is St. Louis itself is about 45 minutes from Ferguson, Missouri. We just passed the 5-year anniversary of the killing of Michael Brown. I was there covering the protests after that killing. I can tell you that relations between white officers in particular and black constituents of that community were very tense. I wonder if you have a response to that, because it is important to pass, as you said, a federal witness protection program. But at the same time, how do you ensure that the police and the community can improve the relations between each other?
Well, first of all, the prosecutors are the ones who make the decision about who goes into witness protection. And since Ferguson's, we have elected two very progressive prosecutors, people of color in both jurisdictions. They have brought new protocols to prosecuting. They are trying restorative justice, and their biggest opponents are police officers and the established legal community, who are fighting them tooth and nail for these against these integrity review units that go back and look at wrongful convictions. And so that tells me the culture of policing has to change in our community.
Congressman Lacey Clay is a Democrat representing Missouri's 1st District in the House of Representatives. Congressman Clay, thanks for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Working in an industry without paid sick time, breaks for meals, or privacy and discrimination protection sounds unacceptable to many. But that's the reality for millions of domestic workers in the United States, who include nannies, house cleaners, and home health care workers. For example, live-in nannies can work up to 24 hours a day with minimal pay and no breaks. And without adequate protections, they can be fired without notice. So far, just 9 states have introduced domestic workers' bills of rights that fix some of these inequities. In July, California Senator Kamala Harris and Representative Pramila Jayapal from Washington announced their sponsorship of a federal Domestic Workers Bill of Rights Act that would implement these laws nationally. Julie Cashin is a senior policy advisor at the National Domestic Workers Alliance, and she worked on the Domestic Workers Bill of Rights Act. Julie, thanks for joining us.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So is there a legal definition of what a domestic worker is? And if not, what's the scope of their work?
There is a legal definition, and domestic workers are the nannies, home care workers, house cleaners, can also be gardeners and chefs. They're people who work inside a private household.
And what are the demographics of domestic workers? I think, you know, we see anecdotally, I guess, here in New York, a lot of the women in particular who are doing a lot of the childcare. But across the country, what are the demographics? What do most domestic workers look like?
More than 90% of domestic workers are women. Most often they are Black, Latinx, Asian, and many of them are immigrants as well.
And in terms of the economics, how much are they generally paid on average? And what is their role in the broader U.S. economy?
Domestic workers are paid about $11 an hour on average, and often without any benefits. And these are the people who make all other work possible. They are caring for our children. They are caring for our aging loved ones. And they are keeping our homes clean and straight so that we can go out and work. And so they are really a driving force for the whole economy.
We mentioned some of the workplace benefits and protections that they don't have, including sick days or unemployment. Why is it that they haven't received these rights so far? I mean, isn't your organization working towards doing that?
The National Domestic Workers Alliance is working to make sure that domestic workers have respect and dignity at work and have all the rights and protections that they need. And there is a legacy of historic discrimination based on the legacy of slavery, where domestic work was done by slaves historically. And so when a lot of our labor laws were written in the 1930s and a little bit later, domestic workers and often farm workers were explicitly left out of those laws. And so domestic workers have organized to change that. And so, for example, the Fair Labor Standards Act, which includes minimum wage and overtime pay, domestic workers were originally left out. Some of that got fixed in the 1970s. More of it got fixed under the Obama administration. And the Bill of Rights would fix the last part of it, which is that privately paid live-in domestic workers are not currently protected by overtime. Some of the other rights and protections domestic workers are excluded from are because they're a non-traditional workforce, because they work one-on-one. So, for example, discrimination protection, which also includes protection from sexual harassment. Domestic workers are left out of the federal civil rights bill because it only covers employers with 15 or more employees. And most often, domestic workers are working one-on-one. So our Domestic Workers Bill of Rights would fix that.
What is it that domestic workers are telling you that they want when it comes to protections? Are they looking for something specific beyond what you just outlined?
Yes. I mean, first of all, they want people to see this as a job that deserves respect and dignity. It's a profession for them. You know, it's a profession. And they want the same things that, you know, we all want at work, right? Clear expectations and effective communication, a written agreement that lays out what is expected so that, for example, a nanny doesn't show up for work and then find out she's also the dog walker and also the chef, right? She wants to know ahead of time what she's coming into. They want stability, flexibility, a safe work environment, and fair compensation.
You mentioned that a lot of these workers are immigrants, and I'm wondering, has the current political climate of the current administration under President Trump wanting to essentially deport and deter immigrants from coming to this country in general, has that affected any of the work you see that immigrant workers are willing to do as far as speaking up more about these rights? Are they more inclined to just work under the table because of fear?
It is a scary time to be an immigrant in this country, and domestic workers have been, you know, fighting against so much of what's been happening. It is a really hard time to be an immigrant working in America.
are, and off of that point, I mean, one of the reasons why we're talking about this is because there was an op-ed in the New York Times where a nanny in particular was talking about privacy and nanny cams that some of the folks that she's worked for have put into their residences. Are domestic workers afraid to speak up? Are they afraid to bring some of these issues to their employers?
I think we hear from some that are afraid, and I think that what we really need are better retaliation protections. And the Domestic Worker Bill of Rights would include that, to make sure that if you do speak up at work, that you are protected against everything, including being, you know, that someone would call ICE on you. The problem is it's not the law of the land yet.
And we mentioned, given the current political climate, this Domestic Workers Bill of Rights Act is being sponsored by Senator Harris, Representative Jayapal. But we are in a political moment right now that is very much where the president himself has cracked down on immigrants. Do you expect this to get bipartisan support and even be passed?
This is the beginning of a conversation. The Domestic Worker Bill of Rights was first introduced just this summer, as you said, by Senator Harris and Congresswoman Jayapal. And we're so excited to start to see so much support in Congress. And so this is the beginning of a conversation about the fact that domestic workers are people who, you know, deserve rights and protections, that if you are a household employer, that you, you know, have responsibilities to think of yourself as an employer. And, you know, we have passed these domestic workers' bills of rights in 9 states and 1 city so far. So we are building momentum. And I think that this will happen over time, but we're going to have to continue to educate people and organize around it.
Julie Cashin is a senior policy advisor at the National Domestic Workers Alliance. Julie, appreciate your time.
My pleasure.
Among domestic workers, the home care aide is one of the fastest growing jobs in the country. It's also one of the hardest and the lowest paid. Just last year, more than 150,000 workers filled new positions to care for the sick and elderly in their own homes. And as the country gets older, the need for these workers will only increase. And we asked you if you've ever been a home care aide.
This is Holly Freeland in Portland, Oregon. I was a home care aide for elderly clients. I did mostly housekeeping and meal preparation tasks. I was on hand to make sure medications were taken. The work is so important for very vulnerable people, but many do it with very low wages. Sometimes hours are not consistent, and paid time off is not consistent.
Andy Newman is a Metro reporter for the New York Times, and he recently followed a health care aide on the job for 24 hours. Andy, thanks for being with The Takeaway.
Thank you, Tanzina.
So what's driving this growing need for home care aides in the United States?
Several things. The baby boomers are now causing this demographic explosion of older people. Americans are living longer. Americans increasingly want to age in place, as they call it, or age at home rather than in an institution. And so you have this exploding population of older people who have increasingly serious healthcare needs, and you need people to take care of them.
You spent 24 hours with a home care aide. Take us through what you saw, the routines, the challenges, and the kind of work that the person you observed was doing.
So I spent 24 hours in May with a home health aide named Marjorie Salmon in Stamford, Connecticut. She takes care of a 77-year-old guy with Alzheimer's. And while some home care aides work regular shifts, like 8 or 10 hour shifts, she is around the clock, most of the time live-in aide. She has her own apartment, but she almost never goes there. She only has a few days off a month. And the day basically begins whenever her client, Bob, wakes up. She is everything to him. She is his day planner, his diaper changer, his, you know, social worker almost. She makes all of his meals. She keeps him clean. She tries to keep him occupied and engaged and stimulated. There are long stretches of time where she's not doing much of anything because he's not doing much of anything. So it's a job that's challenging, in part because there are long stretches of just kind of nothing and you're sort of stuck in the house with this person. But sometimes, you know, someone with Alzheimer's, they can be aggressive or belligerent or even violent in some cases, not in this case usually. So she spends a lot of time trying to read her client, figure out what he needs, figure out what's going to make him soothed and calm and not agitated, you know, keep him kind of as functional as she can for as long as she can. And that's basically her whole life from the moment that she wakes up when he wakes up until after she puts him to sleep.
What do we know about the profile of these workers generally? Like, how much do they get paid and who tends to do this type of work?
So home care workers in the United States, that's a category that includes home health aides, personal care aides. There is about 2.3 million home care workers now in the United States. Their average wage is about $11.50 an hour. As far as who does it, over 90% are women. Mostly they're women of color. About a third of them are immigrants. And there's definitely some connection between the fact that the wages are low, given how difficult and emotionally demanding the job is, and who's doing the job.
Does the job require any specific training? Can anyone do this job, or do they need to have like basic CPR, for example?
I don't know exactly what the training consists of, but for most of these jobs, you need a 75-hour course at least. So there is some training. You know, you don't need a college degree, but you do need to be trained and certified.
Seems like a lot of the workers that we're talking about are performing a lot of difficult and psychologically strenuous and physically strenuous work on a daily basis. What have you found is one of the reasons why this work is so poorly paid?
It seems to be poorly paid because it has just been devalued from the very beginning as sort of domestic work. It's done inside a home. It's behind closed doors, so it's kind of not visible work. And just as the domestic work of parenting has tended to be devalued, perhaps in part because it's mostly done by women, this kind of work, home care, is also regarded as somehow less deserving of higher wages than a job where you need an advanced degree, which may not require that much people skill compared to working as a home care aide.
When you spent time with Marjorie, the aide that works in Connecticut, what was her overall mood like? Was she excited to be doing this job? Did she seem tired? Like, what was her even reason for getting into this work?
So she came to this country from Jamaica in the 1990s. She had always wanted to be a nurse growing up. She said her grandma kind of died in her arms. She is someone who just kind of is a natural caretaker, and she saw this as work that she could do and that she believed in. The first time I spoke to her on the phone, she said, I was asking, why do you do this work when it's so demanding, takes up so much of your time? And she said, I don't know what the end of my time is going to be like, but I believe that what goes around comes around, and I believe in distributing love equally and fairly. So she is coming from this place where she believes that everybody deserves to be taken care of in a loving way until the very end of their life. And she sees that sort of as her calling. And even though this job sometimes drives her a little bit crazy, she is sometimes very tired, she gets depressed sometimes, she really believes that this person is her responsibility, and she wants to make sure that she's doing the best she can for him all the time.
And yet we in the United States don't have really good ways for people to age in place. The home health care aid system right now, I wonder if you see it as something that's sustainable. Is this the way, as people age in the United States, as these jobs become more necessary, is there something that we as a country need to do to rethink this system? Is it paying them more or what?
Yeah, paying them more would help a lot. You have a really high turnover. It's as much as two-thirds of the people who do this work either leave their job or leave the whole career or leave the workforce entirely over the course of a year. It's very, very hard to keep home care workers in these jobs because they pay so poorly and because some of them are very, very inflexible. One expert I spoke to said that in order to make this sustainable, the whole country has to kind of rethink how it looks at this work. Her name was Robin Stone. She's a researcher. She said, rather than calling them low-wage workers, I would call these workers professionals who are paid low wages. What her point was is that these have always been seen as this sort of low-skill job, and because it's seen as a low-skill job, no one is willing to pay a lot for it. a lot of the money stuff around home care aid comes from the reimbursement rates that are provided by state-run Medicaid programs. And those are programs where there's a lot of demand for all kinds of Medicaid services, and the amount that they set aside for home care is just very small.
Andy Newman is a Metro reporter for the New York Times. Andy, thanks so much.
Thank you, Tansina.
That's our show for today. But before we go, we want to mention that we're continuing to follow the aftermath of Hurricane Dorian in the Bahamas. The extent of the damage to the islands is still emerging, but officials have already reported at least 7 deaths and severe damage to thousands of homes. A satellite company determined that 60% of Grand Bahama was underwater on Monday. Thanks so much for listening. Be sure to give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Follow us on Twitter at The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway, and we'll see you tomorrow.